He goes on a little party blower, and he's like, "This guy boring you? I'm from a different planet. Want to come see my spaceship?" And he's like, cut back to the bar. Arthur's like, "Can you believe that? As a pick, a chat up line." And Bay goes, "They do that though."
Yeah, that does happen.
Which is a little bit of foreshadowing for what comes later. Yeah.
Welcome, applauders, to this month's podcast. I am Jen McQuaid.
I'm Naomi McQuaid.
And I'm Lydia Malcolm. And you know what we're doing because you clicked on the link.
You guys. Okay. One of my top favorite movies of all time. And I know it's not supposed to be Naomi-centric, but come on. Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, 2005's greatest contribution to the human race.
Agreed. Like, and even though you've read the book like twice and you've probably interacted with the radio show more than I have, this is still one of my favorite movies of all time. So
the rewatchability on this guy is like par none.
Yeah.
Yeah. Bar none? Par none.
Bar none?
Bar none is how I've heard it. Although it makes sense for par none.
Par like parallel to none. Bar none is like you bar none from like interacting with it.
I think we're already overthinking things.
I'm sorry. I didn't look up the nomenclature of my idioms.
It is way too early in the year for an English lesson.
Which is funny because this is an English film based on the works of Douglas Adams. This movie involves so many. And as much as I would like to debate outside of the discussion of the film, all of the particulates that filter into this, I think maybe we start where we always start, which is, how did you get here?
I don't really know. So when 2005 came around, I don't really remember what I was doing. I might have been like moving out on my own. But this kind of falls in line with Howl's Moving Castle in a few ways, where it's like, I'm trying to figure out who I am. And this looks like it's right up my alley. And then I watch it and I'm just like, yes, this fills me with all of the joy.
Well, Jen was telling me that this happened around the time we got married. So you were there. We might have even been cleaning houses together at the time.
Maybe.
And I cannot tell you when I started. I don't know when Hitchhiker's Guide came onto my radar, but I mean, I read the novel. I was like, oh, this is a classic sci-fi comedy, like two things I loved, especially together. So I know I picked it up somewhere around there. And then I read all that I thought I knew. And then the movie came out and I loved that. But I had a lot going on then, so I didn't fixate as much as I normally would. And then I went to Howl's a couple years ago with my dad. And I was like, I'll buy the trilogy, which is five books again. And I found Powell's bookstore in Portland, Oregon, which is an entire city block. I think they might have closed because of COVID, but I have to double check on that. Sean fact me on that. Shock talk. It's going to be an epic one at the end of this. So, I mean, I found it. I realized that it was six books instead of three. And then I was reading the foreword and I was like, oh, this is so good. It feels like Neil Gaiman's talking to me. And then I got to the end of the foreword and then it was written by Neil Gaiman. And then I had to buy the biography that Neil Gaiman wrote about Douglas Adams. And full disclosure, I'm only one third of the way through that. But like, I feel so connected to Douglas Adams. Like, we would have been really good friends. So it's part of me, just in the way that he makes jokes, in the way that he meters out a joke. Sometimes they're really quick and punchy, and sometimes they're over the course of a longer span throughout maybe even a couple of the different novels. And then a year ago, when I was feeling particularly vulnerable, I might have gotten a Hitchhiker's Guide tattoo.
What does that tattoo say?
It's a collarbone tattoo that says mostly harmless.
But you got it on your collarbone.
Yeah.
That had to have hurt.
The lady was like, if it's on your collarbone, it's going to hurt. So I'm going to put it slightly below your collarbone. And I was like, hurt me. I've only said that in a few different contexts. It's easily one of my favorite tattoos, though.
What part of the book is that from?
It's the sixth book. It's mentioned, however, in the first book. As we go through The Hitchhiker's Guide, which is like interspliced throughout, it's used as a narrative device. So like you're going through the story and it's not like they're pulling out the book every other second. It's just that they introduce the book as a way to get to know the universe of the galaxy. And so then throughout the books, they'll come out with these kind of static I would say, points where they will explain a thing that you don't know. They'll be like, we're going to go deal with some Vogons. And you as a reader who are like, I don't know what the heck a Vogon is. They're like, Vogons happen to be. And then you're like, oh, right. Perfect. Okay. So then in the books, and I don't think they actually cover it in the movie at all, so we'll say it now. The description of Earth is harmless in the first book. And they're like, and Ford is like, I spent how many years stuck on Earth writing pages and pages and pages for this descriptive book that's supposed to describe everything to everybody about how to live and love and life and learn on Earth. And you've left it at the original harmless. And so then they go through like 3, 4, 5 books and then they amend it and they go, mostly harmless. And I felt very, I was like, oh, I feel that. Like, I get that. I am that.
So, Lydia, how did you get to know Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy?
It was through the movie. I picked up the complete set of volumes after the movie. I have yet to read all of it. I don't think I even got, I think I got through the first book.
Yeah, it's only 145 pages or so, mm-hmm. And it's worth it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it was definitely through the movie. Saw the trailer, loved it, and was like, yeah, I'm going to go and see this. Also, like all of the actors in there, I absolutely love Martin Freeman, you know, Sam Rockwell at the time, Yassine Bey, which was known as Mos Def. And even Zooey Deschanel, I had like, you know, fond feelings for. Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of like, yeah, I really like all of these people. Though I will probably say the one actor in the movie that really got me was Alan Rickman.
Yeah. He's so integral. I think even more so in the book. The character that we're talking about is Marvin, the paranoid android. He's just amazing. And Alan I call him Alan. He calls me Nomi. It's fine. We're intimate.
You have a personal relationship with him. It's understandable.
We all do.
Yeah.
Oh, can I tell you, when I worked at that crappy shop at the mall, I would have jeans that I drew all over and I don't know where I got, oh no, I know exactly where I got this from, but I wrote Alan Rickman sex god on my jeans and I wore those like through my whole last year of high school.
For a minute there, I thought you were going to say, when I used to work at the mall, Alan Rickman showed up.
No. I would have started this whole radio show with that. No. Just had very strong feelings about Alan Rickman very early.
Yeah, agreed. Go back to our Die Hard episode for all of my strong feelings about Alan Rickman.
I might have even mentioned the pants then, too. Jen, how did you come across Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy?
I had known of Red Dwarf before I knew of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. And then a friend of my brother's said, hey, if you like Red Dwarf, you'll like Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. And at that time, there were only two options. Either you read what was at that time 5 parts of a trilogy, because I think the 6th part was many, many years later, maybe even after Adams had passed. And I mean, the options were read a book or watch the 1981 BBC TV program, I think, which was in 3 parts as well. So I watched that, and that was my first intro to Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, and I have since read the first one as well as Restaurant at the End of the Universe. Is that the title? Restaurant?
No, it's Restaurant at the End of the Universe.
Yeah. So I've really not completed the story in the books, but I certainly have an idea of the literary story versus the television and movie productions. Mm-hmm. And I remember probably in around 2003, 2004, we had already shared our interests in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, and I had mentioned to you, hey, they're making a movie, and we were both really excited, and we ended up seeing that with Sean and Maddie in the theaters, and that was probably May of 2005. It came out in 2005. I don't remember exactly which month, and then December is when we got married.
That's very, very cute. We all like that. Okay.
Would you like to know some pre-production kind of information before we jump into some of the bigger details, maybe some Sean facts in here?
What if you told us the budget now, and then you told us the money made at the end of the episode?
Ooh.
How'd you feel about that?
Okay. But I honestly don't think that the decision to not make a sequel is according to their reasoning that it didn't make enough money. I think that it did make enough more money to warrant a sequel, but for some other reason that they're not saying, they weren't able to do a sequel.
It's probably New Girl.
It's all Zooey Deschanel's fault.
I mean, and Martin Freeman got busy.
She's not here to defend herself, so
I wish Martin Freeman was here to defend himself. Go at him American Gladiator style.
So the budget for the movie was $50 million.
I mean, it's less than the Cats movie musical, so...
Oh, man.
Sorry.
Have you seen the Cats musical yet?
No.
We're going to have to do it for the podcast.
No.
You really are.
No.
I think it's my choice next.
No. You could wait until March.
I have to wait till my birthday to pay.
No, you don't. I mean, it's on HBO Max, and if I have to, I will, but I'm going to be sucking down that 1998 edition beforehand as like...
And you want me to borrow my LP?
Your LP?
Yeah.
I mean, I could probably find the soundtrack on YouTube, so...
It's true. I'd probably listen on Spotify before I found my record and dusted off my record player and got my life together.
Oh, it is an actual record. Yeah, I would have to listen to it on YouTube. I don't have a record player. Sorry.
I'm sorry. You're not 87 years old like myself.
So would you like to know a little bit of history?
Yes, please. Give us.
All right. This is all Sean Fact related. It was written for the radio initially in 1978 by Douglas Adams.
Well, because he came into the scene, sorry to interrupt, but he came into the scene around the same time as Monty Python. So he was really into, I mean, in college, he was like on par with them. And so like he came out of college and he was like, yeah, no, skits, radio skits, TV skits, this is the future. And so that's what he was prepared to do.
Future.
It was adapted into a novel in 1979.
Tooth and nail. They had to squeeze it out of him.
Very shortly after, that was adapted to a TV series in 1981.
They had to squeeze that rag even harder. He was not down. I mean, like, he wanted to do it, but, like, if you have executive dysfunction like some of us, they're like, you're really talented. This would be really good. And you're like, yeah, no, I'm going to make it. Or I'm going to drink whiskey and not.
Whiskey sounds better most of the time, though.
Than the hard work of getting a thing done and the fear of failure, yes.
Yeah.
It was finally made into a movie in 2005, but there were several stage productions between the TV series and the movie, and several of those included VIP guests as the voice of the book. I'm trying to find the biggest names out of this list that Sean gave us.
You know what? How many are on the list?
Several. At least a dozen. But the biggest ones, I would say, are Terry Jones and Neil Gaiman. And the radio series is still adapting the books and adding new content as of 2018, when 6 new episodes aired on the BBC Radio 4. And Hulu is currently adapting the series for TV in America.
Oh, I'm going to eat it with a spoon.
But due to COVID, it's going to be delayed until 2022.
COVID.
Seriously, like, I'm mad that people are dying. I'm mad that there's lingering neurological effects and cardiovascular issues. I'm mad about all of, like, the serious stuff that is affecting our world. And I'm mad about the people who are ignoring the fact that it's real,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And are perpetuating a thing that we could have cured in 4 weeks, but we couldn't keep our masks on and we couldn't stay home.
Here's the thing. We are not a podcast that talks about that sort of stuff. We talk about media and movies and television, specifically movies.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And there's a part of me that's just sort of like, that's where we should kind of just try and focus on. I mean, sometimes social issues come in the middle of that, like our incessant talking about how people of color are denied the representation that they so deserve.
Yes.
But in the end, it's like we can't talk about all of the crap that COVID has caused. So
it's affecting my movies, though, at this point. It has deserved to be in the social science arena over there, where the political, unfortunately, arenas over there. But here, we're in my house.
We're talking about media.
I could be having me some new Hitchhiker's Guide content right now.
Right.
But y'all haven't kept your particles to yourself. Your particulates are getting in the way of me watching my shows.
Right.
I mean, okay, we can leave that there.
There's also been a stage reading on an LP, a comic book series.
A comic? I would read that.
And an interactive text-based adventure video game in 1984.
If we ever do, like, if we ever get to that level where we Twitch things.
You want to Twitch the Hitchhiker's Guide with me?
Should we just, like, try and find a way that we can worm video game renditions of movies? I mean, at some point we would have to do The Hobbit because there was The Hobbit movie. And then there was The Hobbit game.
No.
We might have to do The Hobbit trilogy.
Okay.
But it means we could stream on Twitch.
Okay.
I don't have a decent camera, but I got a decent headset with microphone.
We got a camera or two laying around. We can make this work.
Yeah.
Hey, Jen, you want to edit a Twitch?
No, here's the thing. Jen wouldn't have to. We would just have to get everything set up. It would be live. And then we'd just say, hey, you want to pay us money for that?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And then we probably wouldn't get paid for it, but we'd do it anyway.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm super down.
Just gonna have to fit that into the schedule too.
Jen, are there any other Sean facts you'd like to throw down before we get to this bad boy?
Probably just two. Adams passed away in 2001, so the movie and the production was a carry-on in an effort to not only complete what he had originally written for the screenplay, but also to pay him homage to his complete works. And then also in 1971 was when he got his original idea for this book. He originally was out backpacking in Europe and reading a book called The Hitchhiker's Guide to Europe.
Yeah, he didn't have any money. So he's like, he goes to like sleep in a field. Like, I think he might have been a little drunk, but he like went to go lay in a field. And he's like, you know, as he gazed up at the stars, he's like, you know, if we could travel the cosmos, I'd need a book just like the one I'm carrying.
Yeah, that sounds like a drunk thought.
It's true. So eventually, I mean, he's got friends that would relay now that it was about 1973 that he was mentioning or talking about this as an idea for a book. And so 73 is really when it started to kind of maybe cement in his brain as something he would like to write.
True. I imagine that. He was doing this like news type topical show, and then they gave him carte blanche to like do... maybe not carte blanche, but they gave him the ability to do a skit type show. And then that kind of evolved into this Hitchhiker's thing. And then he was like, oh no, I have to have a consistent plot and I have to meet deadlines for the TV. And he was most successful when he had somebody who was like pushing him along and understanding that.
Mm-hmm.
He had a Jen who was like, you know, we really got to record by Sunday or we're going to not be on track to be. And I'm like, oh, I should probably get my notes together and call people. Because if I don't call them, I text them.
That's okay.
He had one. His name was Richard,
mm-hmm.
I think.
So basically, Ford Prefect is a self-insert character.
Yeah.
Okay, so
I got thoughts.
Yeah.
Each character is Douglas Adams at a different spot in his life.
Mm-hmm.
So I think he largely identified. Now, this is all
hearsay.
Subjective.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like he largely felt like Arthur Dent. But then he was like surprisingly successful. And so then he was... I know all of their names. It's going to mess me up.
Zaphod Beeblebrox.
Okay. So like he was wildly successful and he's like, I don't know how I got here. That's when he was Zaphod.
Yeah.
Right. But then he'd be like, I'm just enjoying the ride and I don't have to put too much thought into this. That's when he was Ford. But then he was like picking apart his problems and it was all falling down. He'd be like, maybe I'm Trillian. But then there's like half a dozen other creatures and persons that we meet throughout the rest of the novels who expand upon the fact that he was a fully fleshed human being who mm-hmm. was not encapsulated like any author is. No one is like one character you've created, you know?
Yeah.
Just like every time Stephen King writes a character, like that is only tends to be one part of who he is. Like how in Misery, the chick is his addiction to cocaine and alcohol, right? But like, but you can't say that about it because he's definitely the main kid character whose brother dies. You know who I'm talking about.
James McAvoy's character in the second one.
Sure.
Yeah.
Bill.
Bill, yeah. Yeah, he's Bill. In that one, I think obviously that's totally his character, especially because like he has to like, his character goes through trials that I feel like mm-hmm. relate to King's life. But it's in perspective in the moment. And unless, and I'm only one third of the way through the autobiography. No, not autobiography. So like, it's hard to say where all of, especially because, and this is the, okay, I know we're about to launch into this. And guys, thanks for joining us so far. Applauders, you rock. Thanks for joining us. His writing of this and the canon timeline of it is not linear in a way that is just like slurp it through a straw. You are like, this is like you've got chopsticks in one hand and a big old spoon in the other and you got this pho bowl in front of you and you're picking and choosing. Like it's like a whole thing. And like, okay, your preference has flavored how you've ingested all of this, but there's no start and finish to it. Like, are you a broth person? Sure, start there. If you're like a meatball guy, go for it. Why is everything a food metaphor? Doesn't matter. He wrote the TV sketches and the radio show that might not fall in line with the novels that got completed over a number of years that doesn't involve the LP that was like, you know what I'm saying?
Well, I think that was one of the brilliant things about Douglas Adams is that he was able to write for the medium. A lot of authors aren't able to translate their works into different mediums.
I would 100%, unless you've got a really good team behind you.
Or you are willing to let your property go to someone who does know what they're doing. Because mm-hmm. you see that a lot in adaptations. Like, it's like a question of how consistent do you stay to the original property versus like how do you change it in the actual medium that it's in?
Yeah, because like you were mentioning Lord of the Rings earlier. Well, you said The Hobbit.
Or I said
like,
The Hobbit,
okay,
yeah.
Okay, but the Lord of the Rings novels, I remember reading those in high school, and they're a war epic. You mm-hmm. know how fun a war epic is to read?
Yeah.
There's a lot of, and they walked for 13 days, and then they slept for 3 nights, and then they found a squirrel, and they skinned and they ate it, and it has nothing to do with the arc.
Here's the thing. In a video game, that can be fun. So, could you imagine The Silmarillion as, like, an RPG?
I'd have to know The Silmarillion.
I don't know it enough, but I like to think that the way that Tolkien writes about, like, you know, fantasy and how in-depth everything goes, mm-hmm. that it would really be a fun RPG.
Because he builds a universe.
Right.
That's his whole bent.
Right.
He's like, I've written a language. We're going to put that in there.
This story as a video game would feel like a clusterfuck, and I would only probably enjoy it if I was high. But it makes for a great movie.
If it was... Now, here's my thing. Okay, so we're talking about a Tolkien universe, which would be immersive, like the Skyrim series. Wow, we haven't started talking about the film yet. Okay. You could be in a Tolkien place and walk around and either complete quests or not, right?
Mm-hmm.
If this was a video game, you'd want it to be linear. It would be much more fun to follow it in a BioShock sort of like path progressive sort mm-hmm. of situation, even if you could diverge a little bit on these cute little pockets that they couldn't maybe fully flesh out. Like, that could be really fun.
Mm-hmm.
I prefer that kind of gaming. But like, yeah. Okay, yeah. Tolkien universe, Adam's singularity.
Okay, so
we go to the opening. It's like Spyglass Productions or something, right?
First thing we see is a cameo by Stephen Fry.
Okay, like a voiceover, not a cameo.
But it's a voice. He's a cameo. It's a cameo.
Yes. So we get the production screen, which is like Spyglass, I think.
Yeah.
And then then there's like a screen of like generic. Why do we keep picking films with stock footage? Dolphin.
It's this tiny little screen. Like we're like the resolution of this is like in your modern like 1920 by 1080, something like that. Am I getting that resolution right?
The oldest resolutions we had were 320 by 240.
Yeah, it kind of looks like that.
It's letterbox upon letterbox upon letterbox.
It's a square in the middle of the screen, guys. What it's doing is drawing you to a small visual where you're like, oh yes, dolphins. I know what the that is. And then because they're like, did you know? Stephen Fry's just like, you know, humans thought they were the most intelligent creature on the planet. Turns out they're the third most intelligent. The second being dolphins. And then the screen goes from a square and then it's like dolphins, 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 dolphins. Yeah. And it gets bigger and it starts to encompass the entire screen. And they start the song, which I super memorized because it's like the most musically like engaging part of the entire film.
And it really does prep you for the movie that you're going to be seeing. Would you like to tell our applauders what the title of the song is, Naomi?
Well, the title of the song is the first line of the song, which is so long and thanks for all the fish.
This is what we're in for. Dolphins are singing to humanity.
There's a men's chorus, a women's chorus, and children.
Yeah.
And they're all singing, and they're all dolphins.
Do you remember what the kids say in the song?
If I had just one last wish, I would like a tasty fish.
That was beautiful.
And then the lady chorus comes in and goes, if we could just change one thing, we would all have learned to sing, which is true for me.
I think what it really intros is a really big theme in the movie of scale. There's this level that Adams introduces you into, and you think, oh, okay, everything is normal. And then you get to realize that that thing that you saw as normal is the teeny tiny, tiniest most part, just a tiny speck of what he's about to introduce you into.
Well, and that's the thing I feel like, and don't get on my stuff that's supposed to be at the end of the episode, but like perspective is huge in this film.
Mm-hmm. Right. I would agree. I was kept noting that as we were watching it because it was like, oh, this has a moment of like you are pretty much insignificant. Though I think the final theme of the movie is not just that you are insignificant. I think the final theme, which I'm not going to say right here, because we haven't gotten to that part in the podcast.
You can sum it up. Everybody can go home now. Yeah. It's like 15 minutes in. Let's do it.
No, no, that defeats the purpose of the podcast. We have to talk longer.
We must belabor the point. We must belabor the point.
That's actually a better way of saying it. I was just thinking, if we have to talk longer than it takes for people to watch the movie and form their own opinion.
Oh.
That's like our whole gimmick.
Oh, I didn't know that was our whole gimmick. So this whole scene, okay, aside from the fact that it gives us perspective on perspective, right? I called this excellent jam, Blackfish vibes.
Because they're all in like, these are all like the images of dolphins that we're seeing are dolphins who are in captivity, which the real world consequences, if dolphins are actually sentient beings who just can't communicate with us because they don't know English, then that totally makes sense. And it just kind of makes everything that goes on in, you know, SeaWorld even worse.
I can't go see a live mammal porpoise type show because Blackfoot, now they did mean to ruin it for me, but like they got really big brains and I know I'm an omnivore and I got no, like y'all can come at me about it, but my feelings are layered. And so
But, you know, if Blackfish gave you some very bad vibes, then think about it this way. At the end of the musical number, all of the dolphins go away because they escape the atmosphere, because the whole point of the song is they're saying goodbye to Earth and humanity because something's about to happen to the planet.
I find comfort in what you said, because that implies that in this universe that dolphins are staying voluntarily. So I can feel at ease. Because in this, okay, in our universe, I get to feel bad and never go to SeaWorld.
Right.
Which is my plan. I feel bad going to aquariums, but like I will never go to SeaWorld. Right, okay, but like in this universe, they chose to be there because of all the tasty fish.
What if you could be king of your own kingdom, but you didn't have that tasty, tasty food in somebody else's kingdom? So you became a service worker where you could eat all the tasty, tasty.
I'm pretty sure that's the premise of Gargamel and the Smurfs.
Yeah, da, 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 da.
Bringing it down from where we were emotionally.
All right, so moving from singing dolphins warning humans about the apocalypse to bureaucracy, baby.
Oh, I was like, Marvin.
Because
Marvin, Arthur. I wrote, my notes say Martin, and I just read Marvin because that's going to be a theme later. No, Martin is what I titled this part.
He's a depressed robot. Never mind. That's foreshadowing for later.
Martin.
Yeah.
As Arthur,
right,
is my whole mood.
So we come on to this scene where we have the narrator Stephen Fry talking about the fact that there is a man by the name of Arthur Dent and his house is about to be demolished. And Arthur thinks that the best way to try and stop that is to lay in front of the bulldozer.
Well, he says that he knows as much about the universe as a tea leaf knows about the East Indian Trading Company. And I was like, accurate. I feel that. The wordplay is so good. And I think that's what really draws people to Adams's work.
Right.
It's just the way that he'll say something just so. And I don't know if you've ever noticed this, but I will mimic that in the way that I talk.
Yeah.
On occasion.
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry to give away the spoilers on how my brain works. But yeah.
Yeah.
He knows as much about being a human in the universe.
Right.
As a tea leaf.
And going back to the scale thing, is Arthur's house is getting demolished because they have to make way for a bypass, right?
Bypasses have to be built.
Right. And he had every opportunity to argue this because it was in his local planning office. It was just posted there.
For a whole year.
For a whole year.
He had to go to a cellar.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in the book, it's a cellar behind a locked door.
Yeah. I think I remember that too. It was like super inconvenient.
Yeah.
So he's just laying in front of this bulldozer. He's got all of these contractors who are outside his house preparing to bulldoze his house down.
Mr. Dent, do you know how much harm would come to my tractor if I let it roll right over you?
No.
None at all. They make a bigger deal out of it in the BBC show. And so that's the superior one. If you want this scene, BBC show, it's okay in the book. It is less okay in this. Because the guy's beautiful eyelashes make it very hard to concentrate on the fact that he's an evil construction worker.
Yeah, he's a bureaucrat, which is hilarious for later on. But then who gets visited by Arthur but his friend,
Ford Prefect.
This is played by Yasin Bey, previously known as Mos Def. So our notes are very off on this.
Because, yeah, we're going to go back and forth. Yeah. Sorry, because I think Mos, because I'm like, he's the Mos, right? And,
yeah.
But also Yasin Bey, because he is like totally Bey.
Yeah.
I love him so much. And he plays the character. I mean, after of all the iterations I've read, he's my favorite.
Mm-hmm.
And it might be just because this movie hit me so squarely in home.
Right.
But like after thinking about it and rereading the books, I'm like, no, his performance is the objectively the best.
I have not seen any other performers do Ford Prefect. And I can already tell you I want Bey to be the only Ford Prefect in my life.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I will note on the side, in the same way that Americans tended to think that the prefects in the Harry Potter series were just like a funny wizard way of spelling perfect, right?
Mm-hmm.
Prefect is a station in school, like, and I'm not exactly sure the equivalency. I don't think we have an equivalency. It was kind of like a head boy. So a prefect was an actual thing. But when a Ford prefect shows up, they're like, he's a quirky character. No wonder he spelt his own name wrong. No. His name makes perfect sense. You're just out of context as an American.
Right. And he shows up with all of this beer.
And peanuts and chips and stuff.
Yeah. And he's trying to get Arthur off of the planet.
Yes. He's like, come with me. Let's go have a drink. And he's like, my house is going to get torn down. He's like, no, he's like, don't you see they're going to demolish my home? And he's like, What? No. How did you know? and then he looks around and sees all the construction equipment. He's like, oh, this. Yeah, okay. So in the TV series, he negotiates with the boss to wait. Mm-hmm. And he actually negotiates the boss to lay down in the mud for him. And it's just like, look, what if he's laying in the mud, if you're laying in the mud, what's the difference? And the guy's like, I don't really know. And he's like, good, so why don't you lay in the mud for a little while and I'll take my friend for a drink. We'll be right back. We'll solve all of this. The guy's like, yeah, no, that makes perfect sense. And lays down in the mud. I think I missed that in this one. But what Bey does is he passes out all the drinks. He has a shopping cart, a trolley, if you will, full of beer, and he starts passing it out to everyone. And he's like, okay, let's go get a drink. And Arthur's like, what? And he's like, oh, they promised to not tear your house down until all the beer is gone.
Right.
And he's like, well, how long is that going to be? Like, until the end of the world.
How long is that?
I gave it about 12 minutes.
Okay, this movie feels like Princess Bride in the fact that we could talk about like every little thing.
Oh, it's super quotable.
Yeah. So I feel like it's one of those things where we might end up like talking more about this movie than we're able to actually do.
No, what's going to happen is we're going to snowball. It'll be fine. We're going to get through this. Jen's only going to have to edit like 4, 5, 12 hours worth of audio.
3 days worth.
300 years later.
So Ford takes Arthur into the house so he can grab him a towel.
Nope.
No?
Nope.
Oh, I'm wrong. Okay, so he takes him to the bar then.
That is correct.
Okay. And that's when he grabs like 3 pints for each of them. He specifically says,
give me six pints of bitter. And make it quick. And then he lays down like a 130-pound note, if that's a thing, a 150-pound note.
It's probably the last of his earth cash.
And it's not quite the end of this because he buys the round for the entire bar at the end. Mm-hmm. So he lays down what's obviously like more than double the price of, I don't know how much drinks cost anymore. But he's like, give us 6 pints. And he's like, keep the change. You have about 12 minutes to spend it. And he's like, 10 minutes to spend it. Guy's like, what? He's like, yeah, the world's ending. He's like, really?
Yeah. And Ford just chugs back a pint
an
of
entire
beer.
Pint.
Yeah.
And Arthur's like, it's not even lunchtime. Doesn't he say something like, why are you so down?
Yeah.
He's like, it's not just the destruction of the house, it's this. And he pulls out his geriatric phone.
Yeah. It's like, so you know how we have smartphones now, like 15 years after this movie came out?
Mm-hmm.
Back in 2005, for anybody who doesn't remember, you had phones that actually had numbers on them.
Yeah, like a full-on button.
Mm-hmm. And you had like this tiny little screen that you had to figure out everything that's going on with it.
And your lock screen was super important because you didn't have a lock screen and an open screen and a photo album. So he has this chick in him on his lock screen. He's like, this, and he goes into the story we'll talk about in a second, but I'm like, you met her once,
yeah,
and she's your lock screen in what is obviously not October anymore.
Right. Now granted, I'm a cis straight woman, and I don't know how cis straight men feel about this sort of thing, so I can't really comment. I will say, if I met someone one time with this very brief interaction, there's a part of me that would be like, okay, maybe we did really connect for that brief second all those years ago, but eventually kind of have to let that go.
I might be described as a sapiosexual because I have to feel emotionally and intellectually connected with you before I feel any kind of attraction. And that's not to say that can't happen intensely quickly, but it's super hard. And they're both supposed to be these smarty smart types who have like this kind of sarcastic edge, and that's how they connect. If some guy came up to me and was like, remember that 30 minutes we spent together 4 months ago? You're my lock screen. I'd be like,
creepy. Yeah.
Honey, maybe we should not talk. And
maybe if you talk, you should be talking to a therapist. Just a thought.
Arthur relates this time that they go to the party and she recognizes his costume. He recognizes hers. Banter, banter, banter. They end up. He
humiliates himself.
He goes, normally I don't show up at a party like this full bunch of drunken idiots. And she goes, I'm sorry, what? And somebody hip checks the record player. And he goes, all these people are idiots.
As the loud music just goes silent.
And he's like, oh. And Arthur, Prefect is at the bar. He's like, oh, that's awkward.
Mm-hmm. And then they go outside. They banter, banter, banter some more.
They're on the roof of the party.
Right.
And she's like, come away with me. And he's like, what? And she's like, let's go. And he's like, go where? And she's like, Madagascar. He's like, is that a club down the street? She says, no, it's an island off the coast of Africa.
Right. She's pretty much saying, I'm in a rut and I need to go somewhere else. And I want to see if
I want to go somewhere and I want to go with you. Yeah. So why not go?
Right.
And I think that might have been the thing that enticed him to making her cap screen. But like...
This is Zooey Deschanel before The New Girl or The 50 Days of Summer. She kind of got typecasted as a bit of a manic pixie dream girl in the 2000s.
Yeah, I would say that's fair. Yeah. I feel like for what she was given, for who her character is over what I've observed, like, she didn't got a lot of dimension. And for what she could do with it, like, she worked wonders.
Right.
I'm not mad about that.
Right.
But also...
she is kind of the least developed character. Like, it says a lot about Ford that he, creates a guide for the galaxy, and that's his job. And
he's a contributor. He didn't make it.
He's a contributor. Thank you. But it also says a lot that he is on this planet, and he kind of makes things work, and he, you know, can kind of adapt very quickly. Mm-hmm. It says a lot about Arthur that he doesn't really seem to change when he gets stuck in a rut. He's just there, and he doesn't pull himself out of that. You don't really get a lot from Zooey Deschanel's character, Trisha McMillan. You don't really get a lot from her character by, you know, I want to go off to Madagascar and just live there. You know, it's like, it kind of just feels a little tropey.
I might disagree with that, especially later on as we get towards the final act.
Okay.
She, I think, has more space than that, but I will say... I just met you, let's go to Madagascar. That seems like a bit for me. Like, and she's like, how dare you suggest we go to Cornwall?
I just couldn't help but think when you said, I just met you and this is crazy, but here, let's go to Madagascar. So call me maybe?
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, he's like, I just met you and this is crazy. Let's go to Madagascar. And he's like, Cornwall maybe.
Okay, this is like the second song that we have in The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Musical.
So then she's like, yeah, Cornwall. And she takes an angry drink of red wine, which, please. And then, like, you see this belt buckle shuffle up behind her and he's like, hey, this guy boring you? He goes, on a little party blower. And he's like, this guy boring you? I'm from a different planet. Want to come see my spaceship? And he's like, cut back to the bar. Arthur's like, can you believe that? As a pick, a chat up line. And Bay goes, they do that, though.
Yeah, that does happen.
Which is a little bit of foreshadowing for what comes later. Yeah. But this is a guy who's played by Sam Rockwell. And if you know anything about Sam Rockwell.
And I don't.
I only know him as he was in, like, the second Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles movie.
As Hoomst.
He was, like, a guy who was in with a group of, the Shredder's group.
Oh, like a second in command or something?
Sort of. So, like,
I think it was the first one.
It may have been the first one. My TMNT knowledge is very limited. So,
this is your son's culture.
This is my son's culture?
Yeah,
I have a son?
Wonder Boy.
Oh, he's going to hate me so hard.
Mom, I can't believe you.
So
Rogue One's integral to my culture.
So the Foot Clan
Thank you.
brings in new recruits off the streets, and they're usually young men about 14
Do
to
like
17 years
and video
old.
Video games.
That's pretty
exactly.
much what they say.
He says, "What he's introducing everybody. If you want to do something, you do it." And the kids are like,
"You mean I can
you
skateboard
any,
and
you
wear
got any, You got any cigarettes?" And he holds up two boxes, and he says, "Regular or menthol." This is Sam Rockwell from like the earliest role any of us will ever remember. But he's also, he's in the first Charlie's Angels movies mm-hmm. with
Drew Barrymore,
Lucy Liu,
and Cameron Diaz.
Cameron Diaz.
And that's what I remember him from.
He's also in the Iron Man sequel.
Yeah.
As the secondary profiteer, the war profiteer.
Yeah. He also did a sci-fi movie that I absolutely love him in called Moon.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And where he's like this clone that constantly gets like recycled. Mm. And he's like, you know, having existential crises and he sees himself. So you get
like two phases of the moon.
Sort of. But you get two Sam Rockwells for the price of one. So and like, I don't know. Like if he asked me to go see his spaceship, I would be like, yes, please.
I would not go with this guy. I'd be like, can we go to Cornwall first? But that's just who I am as a person.
Yeah, Cornwall, like, and maybe she has extra money that she can dip into. Like, I think trip to Madagascar, and I'm like, okay, but I have to be back here for Monday for work.
But okay, so we cut back to the bar. He's like, she left. I got nothing, right? So then there's, like, destruction noises outside the bar, and then Arthur's like, oh shit, my house, mm-hmm. right? So he dashes. Ford is like, here, I'm buying around for everybody, throws money on the bar. Bartender's like, is it the world really ending? And he's like, yeah. He's like, do you think we should do something? And he's like, if you like, should we put a paper bag on our head and lay on the ground? And he's like, if you'd like. And he's like, will it help? And he's like, no, not in the least. And he just leaves.
In this scene and at the end of the movie as well, there is a lady outside of the bar reading a newspaper very nonchalantly, and that is Douglas Adams' mother. That is a Sean fact.
Really, really his mother?
Yeah.
That's so cute, I'm gonna die.
Yeah, I think at one point you see a paper briefly say something about all of the dolphins have disappeared.
Well, yes, because what we do is we go to the destruction of his house, and Arthur's running up, and they're destroying everything. P.S. The water is turned on. Mm-hmm. Do you know who destroys a house with the water turned on? Makes me mad as a civil engineer.
They didn't get the right paperwork for it.
Yeah, they probably didn't. But like, there's torn newspapers blowing about, and one of them says all the dolphins have vanished. Okay. And so Arthur's screaming, and then all of the construction workers go from demolishing the house to being like, oh shit, and they start running away. He's staring and baffled, and then you see Ford running through, this is where he's running through the house, and he finds himself in the half demolished bathroom, and he's like, all right, a towel. And then he grabs a towel and he runs over and he's just like, here, you need this. And he's like, my house. And he's like, yeah, we gotta go. And he's like, what? And all of a sudden Ford like pulls out his thumb and like thrusts it to the sky, hitchhiker style. Mm-hmm. And he's like, we got to get out of here. Arthur's like, what is that? He's like, it's a Vogon destruction fleet. And from his thumb extends a silver beam towards this giant copper square mass above them that is just massive, right? His thumb is going. Like, then all of a sudden we start panning up.
Do, 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 do. And what's great about it is like the orchestra is like moving with the cuts of the camera, because the camera is cutting from like, these are very sharp cuts, and it's just like from where they're standing to a little bit wider, to a little bit wider, to a little bit wider.
Yeah, we're moving vertically away from the planet. Mm-hmm. And Jen was calling it staccato.
Staccato orchestral hits.
Right.
Yeah. So it's like dun, 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 dun. And if you think I'm going too long, you're not right. Dun, 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 dun. It's so good.
Yeah, and so it eventually ends on the Earth, surrounded by, like, so many of these, like, square destroyers. Yeah,
in comparison to the Earth, they look like the pins on Pinhead, mm-hmm. right? But, like, it was huge when we were down on Earth looking up at it. But then you see it's just, like, all, kind of like how you'd stick cloves into a mandarin orange during the holidays back in the day, right? But it's like the entire Earth is covered like a pincushion, and mm-hmm. then all of a sudden it goes, poof.
Yeah,
like you'd expect it to be like
this big bang, but it isn't. It's just a poof
into it.
Right.
So there's very little debris.
Right.
And I thought it was very efficient.
Right. But it kind of goes back to that whole thing that Jen brought up at the beginning, where there is this whole theme of scale, where you have like, I mean, to me, this moment smacks of you are meaningless.
This is it's a perspective thing that we go back to.
Right. So, and then we get the opening title.
Guys, we are only an hour and a half into recording, and now we get our title screen.
Yeah, with the theme song for The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Yeah,
do you know that ghost, Jen?
And it's actually from the original, the original airing on the radio.
Like Kermit the Frog. A little banjo in there, like plinka 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 dink a dink, dink a dink a dink, The Hitchhiker's Guide.
Oh, and then we get the narrator come back up and start talking about, like, what is he talking about? I didn't write that down in my notes.
The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Oh, yeah, it's talking about the guide itself.
Right, and now it's compared to other books of notable repute of the time. It's even more popular than God's Greatest Mistakes, some more of God's Greatest Mistakes, and who is this God person anyway?
Yeah.
And it compared to other guides of the time, it's slightly cheaper. And across the cover, in big friendly letters, it says, don't panic.
Right. Also, there's this interesting symbol on the front of the cover that for the longest time, I did not understand was a thumb sticking out. Do you want to know what I used to think it was?
Okay, I'll describe it first. Okay. It's a stylized hitchhiker's thumb with kind of a Saturn ring around it.
Right, but it has like these three oblong shapes in the shape of that are symbolizing of fingers, mm-hmm. and you get the shape of the thumb very obviously out. Mm-hmm. Legit, I thought it was a penguin, and the thumb was the beak, and I was like, "Where does the penguin come into play?"
That's glorious, Lydia. That's just wonderful.
Stephen Fry was not the first choice for the narrator of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
This is a Sean fact.
It is.
Go on.
They had thought of many, many different ones, but Stephen Fry is actually one of the best friends of Douglas Adams.
Shut up.
Nice.
And a little bit later, I'll give you a little bit more detail on what kind of friendship they had.
Mm.
Nice.
I like that.
Yeah.
Elusive.
But we're not just here for the guide. We're also here for Arthur Dent and Ford Prefect.
So they're laying on the floor. Arthur has this, it's kind of like a foldable tablet. And he's like, so you write for this, Arthur, I can't do the accent. We're not even going to try it. He goes, So you write for this Hitchhiker's Guide book thing. And that's how you ended up on Earth. Ford already described the fact that he had thought vehicles were the dominant life form on Earth, and he was trying to shake a car's hand that was coming straight at him, and Arthur saved his life by dodging him out of the way.
Right. It was back at the bar where Ford was like, you didn't think it was odd that I was trying to shake hands with an automobile?
Right. So Ford was returning the favor by saving his life.
Right.
And now they're on the floor of a Vogon washroom.
It's super industrial, y'all.
Yeah, yeah. And so Ford's like, okay, we need to get out of here. Because Vogons hate hitchhikers, but they don't explain why they would get to hitchhike on a vessel that the creatures who inhabit it hate them. In the book, they explain it. They have like little scuttle kitchen staff, maybe a slave race. I mean, that seems to be a theme for us sometimes. Anyways, they like let hitchhikers on despite the Vogons. And that's how they get on in the book.
Yay.
But then they have to get off because as soon as they're found, they're going to be killed.
Also, Ford says something to Arthur, something very specific, because Arthur's like, I need to get back home. I need to get back home. And Ford's just like, Arthur, the Earth's been destroyed. And I'm just like, rip that Band-Aid off just right away.
And he's like, what? And then my notes say, there is no way to give bad news, especially in a washroom. There's no way to do it.
Right.
Okay.
But they eventually get caught by the Vogons. Even they like, what is it? They rip a pipe out and then Ford sticks his thumb
in
there.
Yeah, to get better reception for his hitchhiker's ring, which that no one ever explains. And
right.
It doesn't really come up again after this.
Right.
But over the intercom comes the Vogon screeching and it hurts Arthur's ears. So Ford's like, oh, yeah, no, you need a babblefish. And like shoves a fish in his ear and he pulls it out and they shove it back in. And then Stephen Fry comes on and he's just like, a babblefish. Some people say it's why God exists. This. Some people are like, that's poppycock or whatever. But what it does is it takes unintelligible connection and creates intelligible thoughts. So like you don't recognize a language, it deciphers it to something that you do recognize.
Takes subconscious brainwaves and converts them to conscious brainwaves.
Yeah, I don't know if that science works out. It doesn't seem right, but whatever.
The word Babel is based on the Tower of Babel in the Bible when we were trying to build a tower to God. and God destroyed that and gave us all different languages.
Mm-hmm. That is accurate.
Yeah.
And it's why whenever I see the Babelfish language icon anywhere, like, I'm instantly like, I don't like that on two levels. I doubt it's very successful.
Right.
But if Babbel would like to sponsor us, they're an amazing product. Sponsors. Okay. Okay. So the Vogons are like, we have hitchhikers, blah, 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 blah. And they get caught.
Right.
So we cut to the Vogon command room, and like they pull a sparkly crystal crab, which is what I call it, a pretty crab is what I call them.
Right.
Out of this bin of crabs full of mucky water, and you see this meat mallet come down and just start smashing after this crab, and it crushes it eventually, and all the other crabs who have their little eye stalk sticking out of the water, they're like, and they like they have this little audible E, which means they must have like, and I will go back to the brave little toaster. You don't talk through your antenna. I don't think you talk through your eye stalks, but it's a different species, different world. Okay, but like they're ee with their eye stalks, and then they go down under the water. Mm-hmm. And he's only crushed the crab. He doesn't intend to eat it or anything. It's just pretty, and Vogons don't appreciate that kind of conflict in their Vogonity.
Mm-hmm. So Arthur and Ford are essentially captured, and they're like strapped to these like large metal pillars, and there is a specific punishment that is going to be doled out to them before they are killed.
Ford had told Arthur to ask the guide what a Vogon is, and part of the instructions it gave, which are these fantastic computer images, these kind of, you'd view it as like a graphic now, and it was, Jen was telling us that it was unprecedented at the time in terms of like this kind of animation, this informational, what do they call it, anagraphics?
Infographics.
Infographics. So like it's, you get a lot of information really quick, but one of the pieces of information they disseminate is, under no circumstance should you let a Vogon read you poetry.
Right.
So then the Vogon starts reading him poetry.
Right.
And Vogon poetry. I would just a sentence or two, if either of you would like to just go ahead and give an imitation of some Vogon poetry. Just go ahead.
How does blurb confine itself to squavel force? I guess. I don't know.
That's all right. Go for it, Jen. Your turn.
The blabble box of not Autobot is, in fact, most audible. But it'll block is, I don't know. This is, the thing is that it's so bad.
The undulating globules of flibber flab do drip upon my quirvious niddle nads.
Well, that sounds dirty.
Could you imagine folk on dirty poetry? Fantastic.
There was that one, I'm not going to get it word for word, but it's an ode to
the lump of green stuff I found in my belly button one midsummer morn.
Mm-hmm.
I've read it a couple times.
It's the armpit, but I think you're right.
No, it's the belly button.
Pretty sure it's the armpit.
I'm not
talking about there.
It's a direct quote, Jen. It's a direct quote. I mean, like, I didn't get it perfect, but it's an ode to that green stuff I found in my belly button.
It's the armpit.
Okay, fine. You're probably right if you're adamant about it. No, you're probably right, and I'm going to be mad about it. Sean, sorry.
Shock talk.
Yeah, shock talk that out for us.
Also, I wanted to point something out. Ford Prefect has like a very specific physical response to hearing Vogon poetry, where his face is like contorted. He looks like he's in physical pain. And Arthur's just looking on aghast, like,
and he's,
you
like,
would.
Ew, this is terrible.
Like you would at watching some performance art.
Yeah. Yeah, I've seen some interpretive dance that hurts. I mean, I've seen some really, really good interpretive dance, but like I've seen stuff that's like, is this a motion class? And I just happen to stumble in here and y'all are willow trees.
Right. And there's a part of me that's like, this is kind of a missed, this is an aspect of humanity that was overlooked. Like humans aren't really affected negatively by Vogon poetry the way that other species are out there.
Yeah.
In the universe.
Well, because art is subjective here.
Right.
So, like, whereas it's not so apparently to Ford, like, to us, like, I'll listen to another podcast about movies and I'm like, maybe not my cup of tea. And I'll just move on.
Right.
You'll find something that suits you. Just like if somebody says they hate all country music, I'm like, you just haven't listened to enough of it. But even if that's not the case, there's music for you out there, or you're maybe not a music person or whatever. Like, you get to pick and choose how you express time and space for yourself. that's just how humans are. But apparently not for Ford, because he's dying and there's like a skeleton they pan to that's been read poetry to death. And Stephen Fry's just like, and some people chew their legs off. And like, that's for the second worst type. And the first worst type was a chick from wherever, but now the earth is gone, so it doesn't matter anymore.
Oh, yeah, it was like a couple, but that got destroyed when the earth was destroyed.
Right. So he ends and he's just like, you have two options, the Vogon says. You've got two options. You can die, or you can tell me what you thought of my poetry.
And Arthur's just like, well, I really liked it. And
Ford's just rather like, yeah, liked it.
Yeah, yeah, that's good. That's good. That's good. He's like, oh, how did you like it?
I especially liked the imagery that gave light to your humanity.
No.
Vogonity of, and that, and overall something. Blah, 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 blah. Just like every yeah. time you were supposed to give criticism in drama class, it's what you would say. I thought that you gave a really powerful performance. Your volume was really good the whole time.
Humans are the only ones who could actually stand Vogon poetry, and you want to get them out of bureaucracy? It makes sense that they would want to destroy Earth. Maybe this is just a thought, but the subcontext in the novel is that Vogons are actually gunning for Earth because there's this great conspiracy that they know that Earthlings are actually not able to, like, the Earthlings could actually break down their hard, impenetrable steel walls.
Vogon leans in real close and he's just like, so what you're trying to say is that through everything, I just really want to be loved? And Arthur's, and
Ford's like, yeah.
Yes. And he's just like,
poppycock.
Throw them in the airlock.
How dare you, Arthur?
So if you go to our last episode, I have declared from the rooftop that you will never create an airlock in a space-based anything that you do not intend to send somebody out of. It is a waste of production.
Right.
So now we find ourselves, resistance is futile. They shove them into this.
Actually, he says resistance is useless. Which always makes me think, whenever he says resistance is, I always think resistance is futile,
right,
from the Borg.
Yes.
But they probably couldn't do that because Star Trek.
Yes.
And then
like
it was
a decade before.
Yeah. But it was like, resistance is useless. And I kind of love that.
I like it more.
Yeah.
Okay, so they're in the airlock and
they're just standing around knowing that the end is nigh.
Ford's like, do you want a hug? And Arthur's like, no.
They wait and they look out towards the back.
There's a door towards the back and there's like this light that's like, wah, 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 wah.
And then they just drop from underneath them because the door wasn't actually in the back. It was underneath them.
It was a drop door.
And this joke always gets to me because, you know, even though it's like behind, it's underneath them, you know that, you know, they're looking out towards the back of them and you would normally think that's where the door is.
If you want some more Alan Rickman trapdoor fun, go to our Die Hard episode where they dropped him on one instead of three. And the look on his face is exactly how I feel every time I forget that the door drops out. I'm like, oh. You know what I'm talking about?
Yes.
Oh, man, my cheeks hurt, guys.
We should just call it the Droppo door.
Call back to last episode.
Oh, no. I refuse.
Okay. But we will never speak of the Christmas movie that was last year.
No, that was fine. No, that's good. They didn't actually end up at the airlock, though. So this is a superior airlock scene, I think. But it did make me snort when we watched it. I straight up snorted.
Hitchhiker's Guide starts saying that you could survive about 30 seconds in space if you really held your breath.
He says, if you take a deep breath, you can last in the vastness of space for 30 seconds. Here's where the science breaks down for me, guys. Because you're in an environment with no atmosphere. Things expand. Like, you get, okay, if for whatever reason, okay, whereas if you're going to get sucked underwater, what you do is you hyperventilate, right? And then you take a big deep breath and then you get sucked under. That's how you're going to survive being drowned. God, I worry about the weirdest shit. Okay, but if you're going to be dropped into the expanse of space, you might hyperventilate before to get a lot of oxygen in your blood, but then you breathe out before you're sucked into space because you don't want anything in your lungs that's going to expand and break all of your capillaries and stuff.
Right.
Guys, this is a life pro tip that you'll never need.
Hopefully.
And how far away from a sun or a star do you think they were at that point, too?
Well, they're just outside Earth. I don't think they'd moved.
Okay, because in Guardians of the Galaxy, Quill gets really, really frozen really, really fast when he gets knocked out of his...
Yeah, but they make it seem like it's over a course of a minute or two, and this is supposed to be less than 30 seconds.
Right. Also, as soon as they get out there, that's when something kind of pops into view.
Oh, but his phone floats away, so the evidence of his weirdness is never known again, by the way. It's her in his face going away. And he's like, the odds of being picked up in the middle of space is 2 to the power of 207456 numbers I did not write down.
To one against.
Against. He goes, that actually happens to be the number of a flat to which Arthur attended a party where he totally blew it with a girl.
Yeah. And then pop. There's like this like spaceship that just sort of appears where they're at.
Mm-hmm.
Probability of that is what Naomi had just talked about.
Yes. And now you're introduced to the Heart of Gold.
Right.
I love this spaceship. It's got the improbability drive and it's amazing. And I wish I could go into all the science of it, but like they talk about it really fast.
Now, is this the part when they get picked up that they turn into couches?
Yep.
Okay, so you see a green couch and a white couch, and one is Arthur and the other is Ford, and they just sort of say, I think I'm a couch. How do you feel?
Ford, yes, I feel a bit like a couch. And he goes, I totally understand, or the same, or something like that.
And then they scream.
Yes, but and then they pop into human existence.
But they are couches, and they're talking with their mouths as the cushion.
I could have done like a whole movie of them just going places and turning up as different things.
Mm-hmm.
I love that kind of non sequitur, like obscure imagery.
Maybe in the Hulu miniseries.
I will take it all the way. Mm-hmm. Could you imagine they could do it like 3 to 6 times an episode, and I would just be like, ha ha, they're potted plants.
Yes. They're yarn.
Okay, so they're laying unconscious, presumably, on this hold floor. Mm-hmm. And then we pop upstairs to a newscast that she's watching.
Right. The woman that we're seeing is actually Trisha McMillan, played by Zooey Deschanel.
Mm-hmm.
And this was the lady that Arthur totally bombed it with at that flat some time ago.
Yes, but we're pulling into Exhibition Station. Woo, woo!
If we've left you wanting more of our review of 2005's The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, a plotter, don't panic. We still have 2 more weeks to this first episode in Season 6 of our Peculiar Film Walkthrough podcast. Looking for more discussions on film to fill that empty void of space in your lonely workday? Best Film Ever Podcast is a transatlantic movie podcast looking for, well, the best film ever. And Film Rage discusses all things film, including streaming and video on demand. Check out links to their newest episodes in our notes for this release. Hey, this is your audio engineer and time saver having just given up and gone mad now, Jen. Did you know that Shocked and Applaud has stickers? If you'd like to be one of our very lucky few who love to promote pointless opinions while also destroying perfectly good property, all you have to do is send us a screenshot of your review of our show on Podchaser.com or Apple Podcasts, and email it to shockedandapplaud@gmail.com along with your mailing address, which we promise not to share with anyone. We'll pay for postage, and we'll even read your review out loud on an episode of Shock Talk. We'll return in 1 week for part 2 of this British science fiction comedy. From Shocked and Applaud, thank you for patroning the peculiar.